Thank you, everyone, for being with us. This has been a ride.
It has been a ride. I've even had all these emotions, like, after we've done the episodes. Like, I'll go for a walk, and it'll be, like, rattling around in my head.
I mean, it's a really good... It's a good season of television.
It's a good season of television. I'm so proud to have been a part of it. I don't know if we've talked about this, but, like, you know, I have this thing that you work as hard on a failure as you do on a success.
Sure, and you... Yes, of course.
And to do something where the vision that's on the page is the vision that ends up on the screen.
Yeah.
It's rare, right? There's so many places along the way where the wheels can fall off the bus.
Yes. And you don't know. You really don't know. I mean, we knew... The thing that was cool about this, sometimes you make a movie, obviously, in a vacuum. Sometimes you make a show these days, if you're making a short run on a streamer, in a vacuum.
Yeah.
One of the things
without
anything airing is that we started getting that feedback, right? We started, and then it becomes kind of a positive feedback loop of, oh, we're making something people are responding to. And then when you get a script, you know, ooh, they're going to love this. And yeah, this met its promise, I think. People were really hooked in.
It's been cool to chat with writers, directors, and actors on the show for whom it also meant so much.
Yeah.
You know, that, like, collectively looking back with so much gratitude.
Yeah. And the people had a good time doing it. Made friends and got to do stuff they hadn't gotten to do before. And all the writers were so fond of one another. And directors were fond of directors are fond of the cast, and we all had a good time. I mean, it's rare. It's a rare thing.
Yeah.
And a hit, man. Just a good old Hollywood hit. Nothing like that feeling.
Yeah, I dug up a piece of memorabilia that I should post. Not memorabilia, but it was we were on the cover of Entertainment Weekly.
Oh, yeah.
When we came back for the season, for the second half of the season. And I'd forgotten all about that. And I was like, holy cow.
Was it you and Went and Dom?
No, it was just Went and Dom. It was just Went and Dom. But, you know, I mean, the cover of UW, you
it's
know,
a big
they,
deal.
There's not that many of them here. Anyway, before we get down any further on these little paths of ours, would you like to kick off our final Calistine Index of season one?
Oh, I would. Here we go. The final episode of season one is entitled Flight. And as usual, that has several meanings. It was written by show creator Paul T. Schering and directed by our producing director, Kevin Hooks. Flight first aired May 15th, 2006, and drew an audience of 10.24 million viewers, highest rating since the mid-season finale, which was 12.18 million. Airtime was a little different that Monday because Fox was carrying a live broadcast of a presidential address on immigration. It went until 8:30, pushing most programming in the 8 o'clock hour by 30 minutes. So our competition ended up being a rerun of Grey's Anatomy on ABC, of course, King of Queens on CBS, and Deal or No Deal on NBC.
And you know what I'm realizing? When I wrote the script, I did not put a recap in it. So I'm tempted to say the recap is they get out of prison.
They're out of prison and they're being chased.
And the president is dead, so the vice president becomes the president.
There's a lot of machinations, including the cutting off of hands, the poisoning of heads of state, and
the putting on of bicycle helmets, and the overdosing
of Sarah, and the almost inexplicable breaking into a Montana compound.
Yes. Okay, so there we are. That is our recap of the episode we just watched. Moving on with the index. It was a turbulent week in the world with wildfires in Florida's Sun Coast leading to 1,200 homes being evacuated and 300 acres of forest burning. Also ablaze was Texas, where nearly 700,000 acres of grasslands burned uncontained that week, which gives you some sense of just how massive Texas is. That same day, on May 15th, Mount Merapi, I think I'm pronouncing that right. I apologize if I'm not. Mount Merapi erupted in Indonesia, which was just like a super chaotic time of the week. And a few days earlier, on May 9th, President Bush signed the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, which had been set to expire and may account for all of the phone wiretapping in the season finale.
In pop culture and entertainment news, May 10th through 12th was the 12th annual Electronic Entertainment Expo, where Nintendo unveiled its Wii and Steven Spielberg and Mario creator Shigeru Miyamoto played Wii tennis together to show it off. I didn't realize Spielberg had anything to do with it, but
weird,
I can tell you this. Boop, 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 boop. The next day, on May 13th, The New Adventures of Old Christine premiered, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus being the funniest woman alive. Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt traveled to Namibia to give birth to their first child together. And the Hell's Angels sued a division of Disney for trademark infringement in its film Wild Hogs, a comedy about middle-aged bikers.
And there's a joke in there somewhere. I can't figure out what it is.
A joke in and of itself.
But somewhere between Prison Break being rebooted by the writers of Mayans MC, middle-aged bikers.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Like, there's a...
Yeah, there's something... Some kind of synchronicity going on here.
Yeah, if anybody has a good one, feel free to DM us that joke because it's in there somewhere.
Any bikers out there want to sue Fox for the Mayans AC reboot of Prison Break?
I don't know how that would work, but I'm sure you could find
a lawyer that would do it.
Go back into the files and check out the Disney. Long story, I had a friend who was actually an attorney for the Hells Angels for a spell. Moving on. With that, here is the highlight reel from our watch party, a flight that we just did together. The watch party, of course, you can join by subscribing on Patreon on the show page, wherever you're listening right now. Here we go. Like, they're out of prison. It's called Prison Break. They're out. I like that kid.
Yeah.
I hope that kid has a great career and is doing something amazing. Also, was that Timothy Chalamet?
Yes, it was.
Also, what is this little girl doing in the middle of the night alone in this garage? I think Haywire should be more afraid of her. She's up to something.
She's got a Veruca Salt vibe for sure.
Dude, I gotta be honest, I thought that happened in season two. I did not think that happened right now. Ladies and gentlemen, that's what it takes to get a woman in the Oval Office.
Ah!
Series of felonies.
Murders.
Oh my God, this episode must have been a monster to shoot. They had to have had at least 9 days. I mean, you've got planes, you've got helicopters, you've got all the police in the world.
Whoa, okay. We certainly had a good time. Well, I hope our friends did too. Okay, we'll be right back to talk about the episode. All right, welcome back, everyone.
Okay.
Woof, woof, woof. Where do we start? We have a whole list of things.
There's planes, there's helicopters, there's, as I said in the rewatch, I think every cop car in the Chicago area.
Yeah, it's like Blues Brothers.
There's horse trailers.
Planes, trains, no trains yet, but planes and automobiles and helicopters. Mm-hmm. And a lot of car action and a van.
Every guest star
blood,
potentially that's ever been on the show from clips
and
of...
blood and a severed hand.
A severed hand! I gotta say, I thought that severed hand, like right before it happened, I was about to say, if they shot this show now, they would cut this hand off right now instead of waiting for season two. And then literally Peter Stormare came at me with an axe and I was like, why the hand is wrong?
Cut off a lot of appendages in season one. I think
just
it's really
a couple of toes and a hand.
Terms of setting up season two, in a way, it's not set up at all.
You know, you have Haywire on a bicycle.
So the thing I was going
to
say,
look forward to
things that you have, like there's obviously the Sarah subplot.
I don't know if there's a Sarah subplot.
Well, you don't know if she's dead. You don't know if the governor's going to do about it. You know, she's found. It's
she's
like she may not be
found, but that might be the end of it. It might be like, okay, so.
All I mean is it's a cliffhanger.
Okay, yeah.
Obviously, the whole thing is a cliffhanger, but in terms of disparate storylines, you have Haywire running one way.
Mm-hmm. On a bicycle with nobody chasing him.
You have.
Oh, good.
You have Tweener.
Tweener.
with some horses running another way. Hmm. And then you
Trigger
have
and some happy Fox, horse shit.
River.
We're down to five.
Oh, and you have Teabag running a third way.
Yes, bleeding out.
And then you
out.
Have Fox River.
Yes.
Just.
And, you know, we have a mutual friend, Tony Phelan, who is a very accomplished showrunner. He created Fire Country, among other things, and I worked for him. Did you work for him on Grey's?
No, I just knew him through that whole...
You just knew him? Okay, I worked for him on Council Dads. Anyway, he was fond of saying that... I can't remember what show it was, but that there was a showrunner who had a cast that had gotten quite famous and ended the season with everybody looking into a grave. And they were like, whose grave is it? Whose grave is it? And he was like, that depends on who decides to behave themselves.
My goodness.
And there is something very interesting, I think, about basically saying to an entire cast with your season finale, any one of you could drop dead or have already dropped dead by episode one of season
two. Do you get that sense at the end of this, though?
Well, I mean, yes, because anybody could immediately be caught and thrown back in.
Yeah, sure.
Teabag's on the brink of death. Haywire and Tweener are very, very much easily catchable.
I've been associated...
I'm dead. I'm straight up dead.
Associated with two shows that will remain nameless, where they were murdered. There was a long murder investigation, a big mystery, and where halfway through the season, did not know who the murderer was.
Wait, the writers didn't know?
The cast certainly didn't know.
Well, that's cool.
I think the writers didn't know.
I think that's very cool,
actually. That might be a story for offline. But yes, and I also, there's a famous story that we've heard from, I'm sure Matt Olmsted knows. I was going to ask him when we had him on, but I forgot. And many other people who came from the Stephen Bochco camp, Stephen Bochco being Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue, where he would have actors in his office and he would open a drawer and slide them a page across the desk that was their death scene.
Oh, wow. And just say, I've got this at all times.
And say, like, it's in a drawer and it's in your house. Like, it's on the stage. It's just like, wakes up in the morning and slips on soap or like puts a gun in it and kills himself. This can go into any script at any time.
Well, I can't remember if I knew I was coming back.
That's
you
did.
Here's what they hadn't like picked up anybody's options or anything legally. We knew that the show was going to come back. And I remember being really excited because I loved Chicago. And I was like, well, if I'm still alive,
well, that's a different
Chicago is going to be fun. And then we were living in Brooklyn at the time, went home to New York for the hiatus, which was short back then. I mean, it was like 10 weeks. And it could not have been a month before we were going to go back to Chicago when I got a phone call. And I remember what I was wearing. I sat down on a bench on the street in Brooklyn.
Was it a Dallas Mavericks jersey?
It was not a Dallas Mavericks jersey. And although, could I possibly be right that Tony Romo was their quarterback back then?
He was.
Oh, that really?
Yeah.
Dude, I just got a sports thing right. Can we just take a minute?
Congratulations.
Okay, anyway. I sat down and it was our line producer, Gary Brown, being like, we're moving the show to Dallas. And I was like, because I had bought an apartment in Chicago. And so I remember, and Wentworth had a bunch of stuff that he had to clean out where he was living. He had a great apartment downtown. And we both, separately from where we were, different places where we were, flew back, packed up our apartments, and drove? Our cars were both in Chicago, and we both drove, if I'm remembering this right, we both drove from Chicago to Dallas. I remember I drove it. And he might have been driving from LA, but I remember we were on the phone every couple hours because we were like, dude, I don't want to land in Dallas and not have a friend in town. So we kept being, I was like, where are you? And finally, I was going to spend a night because it's like 15 hours. But, you know, I was in my 20s and I was like, no, never mind. No sleep till dawn.
I'm going to power through.
Made it all the way. But it was a little bit of an onset scandal because we were so close with our cast. With our crew. And, you know, they found out like weeks before. Just kidding, you don't have a job.
So brutal.
Most of them didn't come down. Brandon came down with us.
Yeah.
Who we love so much. Brandon props. And Jocko. And we were going to talk about Jocko Phillips. We made a note about this.
Because Jocko wasn't from Chicago, right?
I don't know where he was living out of. But Jocko was from New Orleans.
Right.
And if you were ever on a set with Jocko Phillips on a Friday, you knew he was from New Orleans. Because he showed up in alligator boots and a three-piece suit and a colorful tie. And he was like, there is a way to dress on a Friday. And I was like, you're my favorite person in the world.
Amazing.
But he was our second.
Yeah, he became a first in season
two. He got promoted season two to first AD. You had a Jocko Phillips story.
I have a couple of them. First of all, he was, I think, second on Boogie Nights. And I think he got his nickname Jocko. And he's in one of the Dirk Diggler porn/kung fu movies. He's the bad guy. And he's in that. And then my other favorite story is, I can't remember the actor's name, but there was somebody who came in season two and I don't remember the part they played, but they had a goatee and like a shaved head. And then got called back weeks later to be the same character. And showed up on set, and we were way out somewhere, not near the stages, and he did not have a goatee. And the makeup department was like, we don't have any hair in here. It's on our truck back at the...
Right.
Like, it was a very small unit.
4 hours away.
Yeah. It was a nightmare, right? Jocko walks into the makeup trailer and shaves his head.
Oh my God, to give them the hair they needed to make
the hair off his head and they glue it to the guy's face.
That's Jocko. Like, he.
And you remember season two, all of a sudden he had like.
Gives everything.
Like he'd shaved his head. That was so good.
Because it was kind of chilly and we had a lot of like hats on and stuff.
Yeah,
Jocko came on to Colony. Years later. And I walked by him in the hall in the production office and he goes, hey, Sarah, it's great to see you. And I had no idea who he was. And he turned around and I was like, Sarah, it's Jocko from Prison Break.
He lost like 200 pounds, right?
He had lost more than my body weight.
For sure.
And looked amazing. And he was like, I, you know, had to save my own life. And so here I am.
Yeah.
Still wore his three-piece suits. Just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person.
All right, back to this episode.
Back to this episode.
Let's talk about, there's a lot of twists and turns, obviously. But the thing that I think made us both gasp was right as Abruzzi is putting a gun to Teabag's head, he handcuffs himself to Michael,
It was such a big shocker. And what was interesting about it is when Teabag knocks that CO out, my thought was, I feel like IRL Teabag just kills this guy. But you realize in that moment, he gets distracted by the handcuffs. And maybe that's part of why, that like his brain starts going.
You're right.
Because, you know, you realize that like Teabag has spent the last couple of weeks going, how do I prevent myself from getting killed the second round?
Right, because they're going to kill me as soon as we're out of here.
100%. I mean, that's the other thing that we were talking about is what it's like to be handcuffed to another actor. And I mean that in the literal sense.
Faking that. Being handcuffed on set is always a bummer.
Always a bummer. This is also the episode where we get our first real good look at Terrence Stedman. And that becomes crazy in some ways because when we see Terrence Stedman again next season, he will be played by a different actor.
Like Jeff Perry, founder of Steppenwolf Theater Company.
Right. Back to
where
Paul
recently
knowing everyone.
On a podcast, on the Scandal podcast I was on. And I had never gotten to work with Jeff Perry before. And this was a huge thrill to me. And then today realized, oh no, I worked with him on Prison Break.
But you never had any scenes
I did have scenes with him.
Oh, did you?
Because we have him at one point. Michael Lincoln and Kellerman have him in a motel room at one point.
Oh, you get everyone in a motel room at some point. By the way, that actually makes me feel better that you do that too. Sometimes forget that you've worked with people. Nothing makes me feel worse.
My favorite actors and like and kind of a hero of mine and a mentor of mine to a certain degree. I've known him since I was 20. Yeah.
But there's something about the intensity of working in certain scenes, or just the career is long, or we're old and dumb. I don't know, but I always feel terrible. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful to know it's not just me.
No.
But you said there were a few replaced actors.
Well, Mara Cruz.
Yes, although she was replaced before anything aired.
Oh, wait, really? Oh, I thought
they never aired any of the other stuff with the other actors. Camille is the only one that I think they went through, and I believe.
Oh, two. I thought it was.
The only one that anybody ever saw was Camille.
Oh, I see.
And I have to say, Camille's just so good at it.
Oh, they're great together, too.
They're wonderful together. She's so fantastic. And from what I remember, because I saw some of the cuts of the other people they cast, it was sort of like we're going in a different direction thing, because the other ones were like just incredibly sexy.
Uh-huh.
And there's something about Camille that's like so, like she's beautiful and she's sexy, but she's also like her soul is in everything she says.
Well, you know, there's what is smart about that is that there is something about Sucre that's like that too.
Yes.
Right.
Completely. I mean,
so he's obviously a criminal and he's made mistakes and he's a hothead and he has all these, you know, he can have a temper, but there's this.
He forgets to check if there's an engine before he hotwires a car.
Right. There's a sweetness to him and a like real belief, a real romantic thing going on there. And the two of them together, it really works.
Yeah. Well, you get the sense that he doesn't have to get out to see his girlfriend. He has to get out to see the love of his life.
That's right.
And the whole audience is like, no. In the history of the world, this is one of those couples that needs to be together.
It feels like a great love.
100%.
A great love.
Also, two just wonderful sets of dimples. Was there anyone else that was?
You mean on both of them?
Yeah.
If they had a child, it would just be a dimple. It would just be the absence of space.
There's a hole for under one cheekbone that goes all the way. Okay, I actually very shortly want to take us to fan questions because we always end.
Let's do it.
With no time.
Yeah, and we have good ones.
Well, Fishes, folks, and friends, we will be right back for an extended fan finale on this final episode of season one. And we're back. Like I said, we're leaving lots of time to answer your questions together because we always run out of time. This is the finale. And you left some really, really great questions on our @PrisonBreakPod IG handle. P.S. Some of the other questions that were posted there, we've answered at another time on the podcast, or we've already sort of covered it in various episodes. So that's why we didn't include them here, but we still appreciate them. Maybe let's start with this one. @PrisonBreakForever wrote, what was your favorite storyline other than your own?
Ooh.
Paul, do you have one of those?
I think the Haywire thing. I think the fact that he can see the pattern of tattoos and then his I don't sleep as an episode out was so great. And I love where it took Michael. I love that it made Michael have to kind of figure this guy out and how it took Michael to the psych ward. I loved a lot of the wrenches that they threw in Michael's plans, but I think that one was my favorite. What about you?
I mean, the Sucre Mary Cruz of it, I love so much, and I love it partly because of all of the intentional pieces of the plan. Sucre was the wild card from the beginning. And he feels like perennially the guy who's in the wrong place at the wrong time. Like, that's why he's in prison. And that's why his life took this turn. And so cheering for him the whole time to, like, get out.
Yeah.
And be with the love of his life. That said, I will say, you know, we mentioned this in the rewatch, the cut from Nurse Katie's face to Sucre saying, "I just want to touch her belly," was completely unintentionally creepy. I was like, oh, you mean your pregnant girlfriend. Okay, fine.
All right, can I have one of these that I want to ask.
Okay.
At Shanada 1013, mm-hmm. Sarah, do you think it was Sarah's intention to end her life at the end of this episode?
That's such a good question. And I'm almost nervous to answer it because I wonder if it's answered in season two and I don't remember. My initial response is yes, that I think she is looking down off the cliff of no good options. And I think once she takes the morphine, that level of self-hatred of like all the monster voices come back. The, you know, your father knew you were too weak for this job. Mm-hmm. You don't have self-control. You mm-hmm. can't, you know, like all the voices of just the meanest parts of yourself that I can only imagine are amplified mm-hmm. a millionfold in addiction.
Can I ask a follow-up question? Do you
yeah.
think that she, that part of it is regret for what she's done for Michael? Or is it just kind of nihilism now at this point? Like, I don't even know what I stand for, kind of. It's all over.
Yeah, I don't think it's nihilism. I think her problem okay. is always that she cares too much. But I think some of it is the rewriting of, oh, you fucking moron. You thought he had feelings for you. But of course, you were just a cog in this machine, which reinforces the, like, you have no value.
Uh-huh.
And in thinking you had value, you made the colossal mistake of putting him in, of giving him the opportunity
sure.
to create this
sure.
whole thing. I think Sarah's level of self-hatred at this point is pretty massive. There's also another question of, like, when you're in that moment of going back to using after being clean for, you know, as long as she has been, are you even thinking about the future at all? Or is it
just I looking
want
for some this, oblivion?
Yeah, I want this pain to stop in this moment at any cost. And I'm not sure. But I think she's okay with her life ending. If that's the thing.
That's a very subtle way of putting it. And I don't mean cagey. I mean, it's like, it's not necessarily a choice to end it or not end it. It's just, mm-hmm. where, if it ends, she's obviously okay with that.
So be it.
At that moment, yes. Okay.
That takes us to, and I apologize in advance for this, I believe Andrew Skajuraj. I'm sure I blew that. O-N-D-R-U-S-K-A. J-U-R-A-J for Paul.
I think you did
what
well
there.
What
did you think of your character morally? Like, do you think it's possible that they really do unspeakable things out of their belief and loyalty?
Yes. I made that choice very early. I mean, I even think, in episode one, that this was a true believer and that he was a misguided patriot, and that it wasn't my place to judge. I'm a pretty liberal, progressive person, and this was at the kind of the height of the war on terror, or at the beginning of the war on terror, and I really mm-hmm. wanted to think about people that serve, people that wanted to go fight terrorism head on in that way, mm-hmm. in a military way, and which I respect in a lot of ways. But then as things started coming out about, oh, well, this law, the corners were cut here, mm-hmm, corners mm-hmm. cut here, corners mm-hmm. were cut here, but they were cut in order to preserve
right.
our safety, it obviously raises a very interesting...
I mean, the Patriot Act was renewed the week this aired.
It was, I feel like we put that in a few Calistine indexes. I feel like it was up every 4 months or something.
Yeah, maybe, actually.
And I think that fervor when combined with a personal loyalty, like he has with Caroline Reynolds. Mm-hmm. Really, yes, I think that he believes that he is doing absolutely the ethical thing to protect the country and for a
greater
good.
Even killing the president.
For a greater good. I think he believes that the president is compromised by the company and that this will get her out from under the company. And I think that my belief in that, which is something I did talk to Schering and Olmsted about, not in general, but specifically when it would come up, I remember I asked them to add the line earlier in the episode, don't forget I've always done this for you and your family, and most importantly, the United States of America, that I wanted him to believe that, but also, you know, the last vestige of a scoundrel is patriotism, that they wrap themselves in the flag, that whatever that quote is, that there is a justification of this behavior, of these kinds of acts. Otherwise, I think it would make him a sociopath. Maybe he is. I don't know, but I would also, it never felt like I was portraying a sociopath. And I think that this bears out later in season 2, when we get there, when he essentially switches sides because he decides that he's been duped.
He's sold it. That he sold to the wrong people.
That he's been duped in service of something either that he no longer believes in or something that has been corrupted. But also, maybe he's just on a personal vendetta at that point.
Well, and that's, okay, so that was my question, is how much of the Michael and Sarah dynamic is a little bit at work between the vice president and Kellerman? Meaning, is there an undercurrent of the line is blurred because I care so deeply personally about this person?
I think I think that's where fervor, political fervor, gets complicated, right?
Just political fervor, or is it also a little bit of
that's
a, like...
That's when it gets complicated, is when you put real human... You have to give it real human emotion. And I remember reading Jarhead as prep for this, just because I wanted to read as much as I could about modern military stuff that was well written. And one of the real interesting things that he talks about there is that why they don't take people in the armed forces after a certain age is because they need to bond them to one another.
Right.
Because when you're out there in battle, you're not really thinking about democracy.
Right. You're thinking about the guy next to you.
And what you've been through together already, right? And so, yes, I think there is a trauma bond, is the wrong word, but he and Caroline Reynolds have supposedly come up since she was whatever.
Yep.
Councilwoman or whatever it was. So yeah, the short answer is I absolutely think he thinks he's doing the right things. And one of the interesting things that happens in season 2 is that notion gets shattered.
That's cool. That's really cool.
I have one go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, go for it.
Chiach012 asks, how is it for you and Wentworth to play such various range of emotions, feelings, etc., as your characters have gone through such a roller coaster together in season 1? In such a short time that you knew each other, was it hard to build that kind of trust and reliance on one another as actors?
That's a really interesting question. I think in some ways, our journey got to be the journey of the characters. I don't mean romantically, obviously, but we met each other filming the pilot when Sarah and Michael met each other. So it wasn't the kind of relationship where, you know, like when Tom Scott and I did the Council of Dads pilot together, it was like, hi, I'm Sarah. Hi, I'm Tom. In 48 hours, we have to be playing the parents of 4 children together. How do you build that kind of history?
Yeah.
With Wentworth, we were able to, in some ways, get to know one another in real time.
Oh, interesting. As the characters needed to, because they didn't know each other. And then they had this scene and then this scene.
Exactly. So it's start as strangers.
We're not seeing any interaction between them, by the way, that happens off camera. I mean, conceivably, he's coming every day for a shot and we're not seeing it.
Right. But most of what they...
You don't have a history, certainly.
Right. Unlike you and Caroline Reynolds. I will say a couple things about this. One is, you know, we went to dinner while we were shooting the pilot, before I shoot any of my stuff, shot any of my stuff.
Where'd you go to dinner? I want to know. Do you remember?
I can't remember. It was not at Harrah's because I was like, I'm not eating in a casino. But we were in Joliet. We weren't
in
Chicago.
Oh, you're in Joliet. Okay, yeah.
And so it was like a diner.
Sure.
And by the end of that meal, I was like, this is someone I could really be friends with. Like,
oh, that's great.
He was so intelligent. He was so sensitive. He was so aware and humble that we really, like, there was a deep sense of relief. Coming off of Tarzan, you know, my co-star and I just had nothing in common. And so I was like, oh, we can be colleagues, but we're never going to be friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then because we were on location, we, you know, every weekend almost, we would go have brunch or talk or whatever. And the other thing that really kind of happened, I think, in a lot of those infirmary scenes is we were both really interested in making ourselves better actors over the course of the season. Like, I think we were both new enough. We talked a lot about process, and I remember having the conversation once about, in an ideal world, there's no way to tell the difference between when the camera is rolling and when the camera is not rolling. Because you're as honest and grounded and specific in the lines you're given as you are in real life. And we were really working on that together. And I think maybe part of what was interesting to him as somebody who had so many other scenes besides the infirmary work is that when it was the two of us, it was a safe space for us both to really, like, you know, try stuff and see how it works because we were safe with each other. Like, neither of us were ever going to criticize the other one performance-wise. But also they were scenes with words. It was two pages of people talking back and forth. It wasn't, you know, run, 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 do this action thing.
It's such a cool thing. And it's actually more common than you would think. And I guess it makes sense. Is that so many relationships on screen have a meta thing about them.
Huh.
For instance, Danny Hale, Danny McCarthy, right? Mm-hmm. Who, you know, I knew a little bit from the Chicago scene. He became my sup buddy, right? I mean, we had our scene together. I had done more television than him, so I kind of was showing him the ropes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was my guy. I would go to work with Danny. We worked together almost all the time.
Yeah.
And I had to kill him. It was his last day on set.
Yeah, like, that's true.
I knew is the emotion the same? No. But is there something that actually reflects the arc of a relationship between two people and one has to get rid of the other? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for Wentworth, you were a certain, those scenes were a certain kind of oasis, or at least a different gear than he was playing in any other kind of scene. There was an intimacy, a softness, as you said, a naturalism that is not the same as when he's duck walking through the sewer or dealing with a Bertsy or, you know, and so these things end up kind of, there's something organic about that that is really cool that happens.
And I like it when the Venn diagram between the actor and the character overlaps enough that you can kind of live in that space because it gives you something honest to connect to. Living Correct wanted to know, have either of you been back to Joliet since filming?
I want to say yes.
Because, I mean, you've got family in Chicago, so it would
make
some sense.
Not in Joliet, but I believe... is there a casino there?
Yeah, Harrah's.
Oh, then yes, I have.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, there you are.
Yep.
Do we have a gambling problem we need to talk about?
No, we used to. We had certain traditions, like Thanksgiving night. We would go to night before Thanksgiving. Years ago.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I have, in fact, not been back to Joliet. I'm curious about this. @Cat_McCarthy asks, if either of you were given the chance to rewrite a particular scene or storyline, do you have somewhere in your head an alt ending for...
Mm.
Blah, 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 blah. I have to say, having just watched this episode, and this is truly no shade to the writers who I think are absolute geniuses, but you and I both had the instinct to shout at Veronica.
Yeah, like, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
Yeah.
When she rolled up at Terrence Stedman's house with no plan and no backup and no safety.
And also I was a little unclear, and this is probably just my weak watching. Did she already know that he was still alive or no?
I can't remember.
Yeah,
I can't remember. I don't know if she knew anything about the house except that it was registered to...
Right.
A bunch of phone calls had come from there.
And like you said, no shade at all. But it was one of the rare prison break moments where there wasn't... Like, I thought that there was going to be a twist.
She actually had
this plan. She knew she was coming. They knew each other already. Like, that there was going to be some kind of...
She owned the house.
Sleight of hand, yeah. That there was going to be some kind of trick there, narratively. Yeah. Although that is quite a cliffhanger. Like, who knows what's going to go on? Are they going to drink smoothies together?
I would also potentially... And this might be because I was editing Jessen's episode or listening to it the other day. I would have loved to see a little more Lisa Ricks. Like, I think there's an interesting world where a scene I would have loved to have seen is between Veronica and Lisa.
Wow.
About, like, I can't square this with the man I knew. Can you?
Huh.
Or some kind of, like, what does LJ need in this moment? There's the conversation between two exes who are both deeply invested in different ways. One who's like, I don't want him back in my life, but I'm raising his son. Another one who's like, I can't seem to make these pieces make sense.
Right.
Again, this is no shade. This is just like, ooh, if we'd had an extra episode or two with Lisa, it would have been interesting to see how those two women would have... connected with each other. I have a question. I'm curious about this. I am awkward, Aaron. Where were you when you found out you got the part? Do you remember?
Yeah. Well, I've already told the story about getting the part, but then not knowing if I was going to be able to do the part after the pilot. I know exactly where I was.
Where were you?
I was outside. It's gone now. It was called Vintage Guitars on Sunset Boulevard.
Uh-huh.
And I had just bought this guitar very cheaply. And I was about to take it home and I got a call saying I got that offer. And then I remember getting back on the phone with everybody when I got home. But yeah, that's when I got that call.
Did you go back in and were like, I want a more expensive guitar because I just got a job?
No. I was a guest. Don't forget I was, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was not signing a serious regular deal of any kind.
I Am Awkward Aaron also asks another question.
What about you?
I know. I have no idea.
Oh, you have no idea?
I have no memory of where I was when I found out.
Living in Brooklyn?
No, we were living in LA. We had temporarily rented a place in LA. Home was Brooklyn.
Okay.
But that was back when, like, it was really hard to get a good job in television from New York.
Right.
That wasn't on, you know, a New York show, but they just...
Right.
They just didn't cast them out of there. Where
did you live in LA?
I was renting a place actually on Holloway Drive, which was funny because years later, Josh Holloway and I became friends. No relation. I Am Awkward Aaron had another question. And I think I know some of this answer, but you know so many people. It's a, did you know any of the cast prior to filming season one? I feel like
yes.
Everybody from Chicago.
The Chicago people. Not many people.
Wade had done that Michael Mann movie.
I knew Wade the best because we had done a movie together. Knew Danny a tiny bit and nobody else, I don't think. I'd met Robin in high school, but she was scary and beautiful and I kept my distance.
And you were pretty sure she was in a witchcraft cult.
It was before that, but yeah. You?
Yeah, I'm not a person. I didn't know anyone in Hollywood.
Right. Did you know anybody, any of the directors, any of the writers, any of the...
Nope.
Nobody.
This is my introduction to everybody. Single person.
And just a reminder that Marty Edelstein, the producer of the show, no relation, didn't know him either.
He's Paul's father, but, you know,
no,
that's okay. He doesn't want us to know. He's the one who almost named him P. Earl.
He's not Harvey.
Fine.
Marty.
Your dad's name is Harvey?
Harvey Martin, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
I like that. We should probably wrap this up soon, but we're getting through these. Oh, this is interesting. Dangavrilov, again, I apologize, at IDANGAVRIELOV. At which stage of season one did you know you were doing another season?
No, I mean, as an actor or like that the show had gotten picked up?
We've answered it as actors, but about the show?
No idea. I have no recollection of that.
I don't know, but I do know that by the time we wrapped season one,
I mean,
we knew there was going to be a second season.
Pretty
like
early.
The numbers were high enough.
We knew early. It was a hit.
Awards and stuff, but
it was
interesting.
In those
because
days.
I didn't realize later on that you could have a nail biter of leaving at the end of the first season and going, I have no idea if we're going to come back and do another season. Right? Because I did Prison Break and then I did Walking Dead. And it was like both of those shows, by halfway through probably season one, you're like, okay, this is going to go for a while.
So when did we know, and when did we know that we were coming back as actors? You raised it earlier in this podcast. When you got a script that said Sarah's unconscious with vomit all over her and a needle, were you like,
it says dead.
It says
dead? I checked. My script says dead.
I heard the EMT say likely DOA.
No, the script says debt here. I can.
Were you, you were a partial, right? You weren't 22 out of 22 contract?
No,
wise?
I was 10-13.
Yeah, there you go.
I ended up in every episode, much to my surprise. But the more interesting conversation, and this for later, is finding out between seasons two and three that I was not coming back to the show.
Right.
But I don't remember. I really don't. And I don't know that the writers necessarily knew because they probably hadn't broken season two to be like, well, how do we keep her a part of this thing?
Definitely not. Right.
Sorry. We don't really have a good answer for you there, friend. Joy Padron wants to know your favorite guest star from season one. You can't say yourself because technically you said you were a guest star for somebody.
Ooh. I love John Hurd's work so much that I loved seeing John Hurd in there.
For some reason, and I can't remember her name, but the actor who played Letitia Barris, she impressed.
Oh, Adina.
God,
I see her around.
Good.
She's an amazing actor. She's
an amazing actor.
She never stops working, and you see why. She's just a great
actor.
She was
astonishing.
Yeah.
She's really fantastic.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
I think we got through most of these. We should wrap this up.
Oh, so fun. Glad we have many more seasons to do.
Same. And I know I've said it before, but I'm really glad that I'm doing this with you. Enough. There is no call-in this week. So stay tuned in coming weeks for us to play your call-in messages and respond to them.
And also important to note that although this does conclude episodes for season one, we have a very special interview coming up that will be to our series creator, Paul T. Schering. So check that out too, because that's going to be really cool.
And again, if you want to catch up on Watch Party episodes, you could follow the Patreon link in the show page wherever you're listening right now. And just thank you guys. You're the best. Thank you for calling in and Instagramming your questions and sending your fan art and listening to the show. It's fucking beautiful. We love you guys. And Paul,
yep.
Your last meal on death row.
Okay.
If it was today, what would it be?
I'm going to go with some kind of big Italian meal. Like bucatini or penne with sausage and a big antipasto and like panna cotta for dessert and olives, bread, and just a big butter and wine, and just a kind of big, meaty, carby.
From Buca di Beppo, right?
From Buca di Beppo, sure. Remember, folks, don't get sent to prison, but if you do get sent to prison, remember to.
I never have a good answer to this. If you do get sent to prison, remember to make sure your father is the governor who can personally pardon you.
Wow.
That's all I got. Do you have something better? You should have something better.
Well, I do have something better. We can now save it for next time.
No. What if there's never a next time?
What do you
Carpe
mean?
Carpe diem. Carpe dentum. Seize the teeth. Go.
It's funny. Let me know. You got to set me up.
Okay. Paul, don't get sent to prison. But if you do go to prison,
make sure you have access to prison breaking, Sarah and Paul, so that you can make time serve you by listening to our podcast.
This is amazing. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production. Your hosts have been friends, but not besties, Sarah Wayne Callies and Paul Edelstein. Our prison warden has been producer Ben Haber. Our head of jailhouse rock is Paul Edelstein, who made the music for this podcast. Keeping us slim and trim, the prison yard, has been sound designer and editor, the great Jeff Schmidt. Keeping us up to date on the outside world is production assistant Drew Austin. Our prison artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato and Little Big Brands. Check them out at www.littlebigbrands.com. Follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. Email us at prisonbreaking@caliber-studio.com and call us at 401-3-PBREAK. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber Studio production. Thank you for listening.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.